for everyone who loves books. This is Read on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, your weekly compendium of the best in books and reading. I'm your host, Red Sale, and today we're exploring the life, legacy and literature of one of the country's best-loved authors, Catherine Cookson. We explore her remarkable life with her biographer, Kathleen Jones.
I said, so what do you love about Catherine Cookson's novels? And she said, because she is writing about my life.
Robert Kirkwood discovers some of the artefacts at the South Shields Museum dedicated to preserving her memory.
We've got the dictaphone that she recorded. She only ever wrote 16 books by longhand. The rest were recorded on a dictaphone.
Narrator Elizabeth Proud reminisces about recording some of Catherine Cookson's novels for the RNIB Talking Books Library.
And this is at the essence, I think, of Catherine Cookson's philosophy, probably from her own very difficult life.
And I immerse myself in the harsh realities of the 15 streets. That's all coming up in today's Read On. Dame Catherine Cookson passed away 20 years ago this week. During her 91-year lifetime, she published 97 books, with several more appearing posthumously. She was also a great philanthropist, donating much of the money that she made from writing to good causes. Since her death, the Catherine Cookson Charitable Trust has continued this work, generously supporting RNIB to provide blind and partially sighted people with access to books and learning. Cookson was no stranger to adversity herself. Born into abject poverty, she survived a terrible childhood and poor physical and mental health to become the country's most popular novelist and a national treasure. To celebrate the life and legacy of this remarkable woman, RNIB Connect Radio has a special Catherine Cookson Week, and where better to pick up her story than here at Read On. Kathleen Jones is Cookson's biographer, and as we'll hear, she's unearthed some pretty astonishing facts. But first, I wanted to know what drew her to write about Catherine Cookson's life.
It came about because my mother actually comes from North Shields, which is the other side of the Tyne, where Catherine Cookson was born and brought up. But my grandmother, her mother, came from South Shields. So I had a definite connection to Catherine Cookson country. And when Catherine Cookson died, my publisher rang up and said, wouldn't it be great if someone who really knew the area and who lived in the north, wasn't a posh English southerner, could write a biography of Catherine Cookson? Would you be interested? And so, of course, I said yes, because at the time I was actually standing on the banks of the Tyne. I'd gone over there for a family, something to do with family. And I was standing on the banks of the Tyne and I thought, this is fantastic.
Very serendipitous. Catherine Cookson had, of course, written her own autobiography, but you were to discover that that was just the tip of the iceberg.
Yes. Like most people, Catherine had a standard story that she told about herself and her life. It appeared to be very frank because she very honestly wrote about being very, very poor, having to go out. Her mother went out barefoot, begging at times. And she wrote about that very frankly and about a lot of other things. And so it was like a case of hiding in plain sight that Catherine didn't tell some of the more shocking details of her life. And she wasn't wholly honest. She constructed a story that seemed very frank, very raw, but it was concealing another story underneath that she had intended to write about. And then when she began to write about it, realized that she couldn't tell the whole truth about herself.
And the search for that information took you to the Boston Library, I believe, in the United States?
Yes, I realized doing a university search, that some of her manuscripts had gone to America. And so I made inquiries over the internet and discovered that all the early drafts of her autobiography, Our Kate, and there were eight of them, had gone to the Boston University Library. And quite early on. She sold it soon after she published Arcade. So I thought, this is amazing. 8 drafts. Why did she have to rewrite it so many times? And I thought, I must go and have a look. And so I managed to get some money from my publisher. And I went to Boston, to the library. And there were boxes and boxes of some handwritten manuscripts, some typed. Right from the beginning of her work on writing her autobiography, she was trying to write herself out of depression and almost writing as therapy, writing about her life, all the things that had upset her, her mother's behavior, the lack of her father, her the love affair of Nan Smith, the woman who gave her so much trouble, and her relationship with Tom. And so there was this wonderful treasure trove of material that one version of this went to about 800 pages, but the finished version of Arcade is only 200 or 300 pages long. So you can see that she cut an awful lot out.
How did you feel holding this previously unseen, unpublished material and knowing that actually some of it, you know, the love affair with another woman, the alcoholic mother and abuse that Catherine Cookson received from her, was really going to be quite sensational when it got out into the public eye?
I felt very awkward. Things became even more explosive because on my return from America, when I opened my front door, my neighbour had stacked my mail up on the stairs. And on the stairs was a gigantic jiffy bag. And when I opened it, out of curiosity, it was full of tapes, cassette tapes.
But after 4 months, or 4 or 5 months of this, I thought, she's a good woman. She's done more for me than anybody in my life. You know, she's worked for me. She's given me things. She thinks of nobody but me. I'm not going to keep her hidden any longer. So I went to the matron and I said, I think I better tell you, matron, that you know Mrs. Smith. I said that I'm going to be friends with her openly. I said, the thing is, I know our positions are different and I know you don't like this kind of thing, you know, one of the daily workers. Yes, and I'm I was an officer, you see. I said, but I said, I can't stand this underhand business. I said, and I'm going to, that was it. I'm going to sort of share my flat with her. That was it. She nearly went through the roof.
They had been sent to me with a letter by Catherine's very first literary agent, John Smith, who had looked after Catherine for most of her writing life. And she had made these tapes for him because she wanted him to be her biographer. But when he wrote the biography and he showed it to her, she suddenly realised everything she told him and what this was going to look like. And she went absolutely ballistic and said, there's no way this is going to be published. And so she paid him. It was a sort of pay and kill operation. She paid him not to publish the biography. And there was an agreement that it would be destroyed. But he kept these tapes, which he legally owned, and he sent them to me. And I think there was maybe a slight element of revenge in this, that he hadn't been allowed to tell her story, but I could. So he sent them to me and said, do with them what you like.
You're mad. The master came to me. She's a very nice woman, but you're mad. Anyway, the matron ran a dance once a fortnight down in her basement. And you wouldn't believe it, this type of woman. She was a French woman, too. To try to stop me being friends. I told you about going into the, didn't I, when I went into our office. Oh, dear, 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 dear. So what did she do? But she tried to make friends with Mrs. Smith to stop me being friends with her.
And the tapes were even more revealing than the manuscripts in America had been. This was Catherine on tape, using her in her own voice, telling John all these things about her life and just talking, you know, talking without pause. He hardly has to put a question in. She just talks about her life. And once she gets going, there's absolutely no stopping her.
My mother was a lady, you see. She's a lady. You see, just on her appearance and my mother, you know, was charming. no jokes, but very smiling and very kind. And she didn't talk roughly. Kate never talked roughly, you see. But when she met the matron disliked her on sight and she disliked the matron. Now, the matron didn't know I was illegitimate until I asked for my birth certificate, you see. She asked me for my birth certificate for the application or something, and I had to send to Kate. I said, I haven't got one, and I told her. She says, well, I knew. I said, well, how did you know? She said, you know, she said something like, well, we don't get them like you every day. She said, of course I knew you were different.
And these were very, very revealing. It included things that hadn't been in the manuscript. Things like Nan Smith turning up on her wedding day with a gun and threatening to shoot her. And she feared when she went to the church with Tom that Nan would be there and that she would actually carry out her threat. This is the material of novels. It's not real life, and it's certainly not something that you'd associate with this lovely old lady that used to appear on television in the North two or three times a year, sitting up in bed in a pink fluffy bed jacket and giving lots of money to charity. These were quite explosive things. At one point, she talks about she gets quite hysterical, and she talks about wanting to go to the cemetery and dig up Nan's bones and jump on them because she's so angry with her.
It really is a phenomenal story, and I mean, your hands must have been shaking when you were listening to these tapes. How do you, as a biographer, avoid the voyeuristic and balance the fact that you're handling a woman who was regarded as a national treasure and yet lifting the veil on some of the really quite sensational things that happened in her life?
This is one of the very great difficulties of a biographer, that you always hope that there's going to be something that you uncover that no one's previously unknown, not known, but you really don't want to have this kind of revelation. Catherine Cookson was regarded, certainly in the North, as almost a saint, and her fans loved her. And to then have these things revealed was obviously going to be very traumatic. My answer to this was not to put everything in. I left out of a great deal, and I tried to keep the emphasis on facts, not speculation, just facts, and to let the facts speak for themselves, not to allow myself to get into any kind of embellishment or emphasis. So it was putting in facts. It was keeping back a lot of things that I felt would be just too much for people, particularly her fans. And also, the direction of the biography that I wrote was mainly about her as a novelist and about her novels and how important they were to the culture of the North.
And one thing that really comes through is how seriously she took writing. She definitely saw herself as a historical novelist and was really rather irked by the constantly being called a romantic novelist. She saw herself as reflecting the culture of the world she'd grown up in. And I believe she was a stickler for her research.
Absolutely. And her novels are not romances. They're not romantic in the least. They're absolutely brutal. There is a lot of violence in Catherine Cookson's books. If anyone refers to her books as romantic, then they obviously haven't read them. They are very violent, full of domestic abuse, particularly towards women. Very tragic things happen. There is incest. There is rape. And all sorts of terrible things happen to her characters. And it is very, very rare for one of Catherine Cookson's novels to end happily. She did write some lighter novels, some lighter romantic novels, under the name of Catherine Marchant. And there were one or two humorous romantic novels that she wrote on the fringes. But most of her novels, and particularly the historical novels, have this brutal quality about them. And this was underlined by the fact that I was asked to go into a prison, a very high security prison and talk to some of the women prisoners there, who were all in for very, very serious crimes, manslaughter, murder, this sort of thing. And I talked to them about it, and they loved Catherine Cookson. And I said to one girl who was about 19, I said, "So what do you love about Catherine Cookson's novels?" And she said, "Because she is writing about my life." And I think that is why a lot of people love Catherine Cookson, because there are a lot of people who are living in poverty, in very difficult circumstances, living with domestic abuse and institutional abuse of quite extreme varieties. And for them, Catherine Cookson is writing about things that don't get talked about openly in society, but are part of the reality of their day-to-day life.
Yes, I mean, I've recently read The 15 Streets and was struck by how Dickensian it is in many ways. Do you think it was that same shout for social change that drove Cookson as drove Charles Dickens?
I'm not sure. Catherine was, in the end, very egotistical. She was very wrapped up in her own story and in herself. And I think she was writing for herself rather than writing for any big social agenda. She was writing about the horror of what she'd suffered, what her mother had suffered, what her grandparents had suffered, and she was drawing on their stories. But I don't think she had any social agenda in mind. She simply wanted to write the truth of what had happened.
And you mention, obviously, that she found great success in her lifetime. Do you think she enjoyed that success?
Oh, she did. Catherine had a gigantic chip on her shoulder from her very poor beginnings. She never felt she deserved those beginnings. This is why she had, as a child, invented this gentleman father who was going to come one day and take her out of poverty, because she felt that intellectually and socially she didn't belong in the class that she was born into. She wanted to make something of herself. This occurs again and again and again in her autobiography. I wanted to make something of myself. I wanted to show them, she says. I wanted to show them what I was made of. So there's this tremendous ambition that drives her to lift herself above all this. And every book she wrote, every penny that went in the bank, was a step away from The 15 Streets and little Kitty McMullen, who was illegitimate and was teased by the other children and had to go to the pawn shop for her mother. So she loved it, the fur coat, the attention, the press interviews, the books, her publishers absolutely worshipped her, because she kept two publishers going because of the amount of money she was making and the number of books that were being sold. Took two publishers to actually support that. She was said at one point to be the most valuable industry on the Tyne. She was generating more money than any other industry in the northeast of England.
Do you have a favourite Catherine Cookson novel yourself?
I have several, because she wrote quite a few different ones. And of the historical novels, I think The Black Velvet Gown is my favourite, particularly because it concerns female education and the politics around female education, and also working class education. And that's something I care very much about, equality of education for everyone, regardless of their class or their financial position. And I love The 15 Streets because it's one of her earlier novels, and she's writing about where she grew up, and it is a beautiful novel. And I also like Fenwick Houses because she was writing about her mother, and she writes it in the first person. And it's a beautiful, graceful novel, which is about, she said it was about Kate as Kate could have been if Kate had had a very different upbringing. Those are my favourite three.
And was she a great reader herself, or was she too busy writing?
She didn't read other novelists at all. That was really quite sad, because I think to be a very, very good writer stylistically, you have to read what else is being written in fiction. But she did read a lot, particularly in her early years. She was totally self-educated. I mean, this is a girl who left school at 13 having not had much education. She was the sort of child that the education enforcement officers were always at the house, because she was kept off school to help Kate with the laundry or to run errands or whatever. So she didn't get much schooling. She was then completely self-educated, and she set herself a program of reading from the library so that she could educate herself. So she read all sorts of things, including all the big 19th century novels, which she didn't like very much. But a lot of non-fiction. Non-fiction was her favourite stuff. And she read a lot of non-fiction when she was researching her historical novels to make sure she got the details right. So that sort of reading, but not fiction.
And, of course, she also liked to be hands-on, didn't she? I love the story of her going down a mine so that she could describe it properly for one of her novels.
Yes, that was for Maggie Rowan. And that was one of her cousins who took her down a mine because she was quite prejudiced towards miners. They were a lower social class for Catherine Cookson and her family. And she was taken down the mine. And from then on, she had the utmost respect for anyone who was a miner.
Well, Kathleen Jones, thank you so much for sharing those wonderful insights into Catherine Cookson's life.
Thank you. It's been a great pleasure to talk about a writer I admire very much indeed. She was absolutely extraordinary, and her life was equally extraordinary.
Seth could have taught lots of men in the rows to read and write, but they were afraid in case the pit keeper split on them to the manager, because reading was frowned upon. And as some of the older men had pointed out forcibly to Seth, it got you nowhere except in trouble with those that provided your livelihood. Not only did education make them unpopular with their employers, it did nothing to improve their social conditions. As Catherine has one of her characters remark in The Malin Litter, "What are they after? Them up there. Eh? Forcing them to school? You can't fill their bellies with reading and writing."
Joyce Gibbs narrating Catherine Cookson, The Biography, written by my guest Kathleen Jones. It's available from the RNIB Library in Braille and as TB 11866. A new edition of the book is out next week in paperback and ebook under the new title Catherine Cookson, A Child of the Time, with an audiobook on its way. And Kathleen will be back at the end of the show to share the books of her life. Catherine Cookson will forever be associated with the Tyneside town of South Shields. The area features extensively in most of her books, and the South Shields Museum, which at the moment is hosting an exhibition of her paintings, holds many other Catherine Cookson items, including her kitchen sink. Robert Kirkwood talked to tour guide Angus MacDonald and began by asking him how important Catherine Cookson was to the area.
Well, I think she was very important in her time. She put South Shields on the map, so much so that the town council devoted a large section of the town, renamed it Cookson Country. She was very important to the town. I mean, she brought in thousands of visitors. There's a trip in tomorrow, a Cookson trip. But I mean, at one time, we would have nearly 200 trips a year to see the Cookson Country and come to the museum. We had a large display on, sell all our books and DVDs.
So what would happen on a Cookson trip?
The Cookson trip would go around various places around the town, and then they were marked with a blue pole with a date on the top. So the church where she worshipped, the hospital where she worked, the house where she lived.
And I believe the museum has a room that was modelled on her kitchen.
Indeed. We have a whole street that was modelled on William Black Street, one of the streets where she lived as a young girl. We've got a mock-up of the kitchen where she wrote a very, very early works of 10 William Black Street. It was a street set up for chemical workers on what is now known as the South Shields Bead Estate. But Catherine designed the kitchen, and she actually opened the kitchen.
And you've got her hair as well.
We have. She had very, very long waist-length hair. As a young girl, she wore pigtails. And then for some inexplicable reason, she cut this hair off one night, but she kept it under a pillow. And she slept with it under a pillow for many years. And when she died, and we got bits and pieces from the estate, the hare was with it. Strange but true, but, you know, there we go, you know.
What else does the museum have of Catherine Cookson's?
We've got lots of our clothes. We've got lots of our jewellery. She had some very nice jewellery. We've got a chair. We've got the dictaphone that she recorded. She only ever wrote 16 books by longhand. The rest were recorded on a dictaphone. Then, of course, we've got many awards that she won, an Emmy that she won for Black Velvet Gown, and the book she was presented with on This Is Your Life. Yes, which is nothing in it except coloured photographs, a few photographs. We've got quite a few of her belongings, handbag, etc., etc. Painting. Kitcher's an artist as well. So we've got lots and lots of Catherine Cook and memorabilia, but it isn't all on display at the moment.
Yeah, that's something I didn't know, that she also was a painter as well.
Yeah, she painted. She did some drawings, and we've got three or four of our oil paintings, and of course we've got the paints and all the easel, etc., etc. You know, we bought lots of her estate, unfinished scripts and stuff. She wrote 124 books.
So if someone wants to find out more, where can they go?
www.southshieldsmuseum.org.uk, or they could ring the museum on 0191 211 5599.
Thanks to Robert and to Angus MacDonald. That number again is 0191 211 5599. You're listening to a special edition of Read On, this week celebrating the life and work of Catherine Cookson. For 17 years until 2002, Dame Catherine Cookson was the most borrowed author from British libraries, and the RNIB library was no exception. Braille, giant print and talking book versions of almost all of her books are available and continue to be lent in significant numbers. Over the years, many narrators have given voice to Catherine Cookson's stories. None more so than Elizabeth Proud. It's a real treat today to be joined by Elizabeth Proud, who's been working as an RNIB narrator for 52 years now, Elizabeth?
That's right, yes. I can't really believe it myself.
You're here to talk about Catherine Cookson, eight of whose books you've narrated, including all of the Tilly Trotter trilogy.
Tilly Trotter, yes.
Did you read them all in one go, or were they spread over a series of years?
When they cropped up, I was told, you do what you're told here, you used to. So I started doing Catherine Cookson because there was nobody else who could do the accent. And I come originally, although you wouldn't believe it now, I come originally from the Northeast. Indeed, my mother was born in West Hartlepool. So there you go. And having done one, of course, they reach for you again when the next one comes up.
They're a wonderful slice of life that has long gone, a very hard life. A very brutal life in some respects, but they're almost historical documents within themselves, aren't they?
I think they probably, I think they've probably become a bit better than when they were first written. It's interesting that books do that because, as you say, they are sort of historical documents. I mean, life really was like that for a lot of women in the Northeast. The poverty was pretty bad. My mother was born in 1912, and she went through the 30s, the Jarrah marches and all of that. And she had stories to tell about her father stealing pheasants' eggs in the countryside. Otherwise, they wouldn't have anything to eat. So, yes, they are historical documents now. But it's also interesting because her own life, Catherine Cookson's own life, was tremendously hard. My mother had a phrase, because she didn't have a very easy life. Her husband was killed very early on in the Second World War, and she was an infant school teacher. That's what she had, a piece of paper to say that she was qualified to teach infants. She ended up a lecturer in London University
on fabrics and dyeing and, you know, and wrote three books. So in a way, I've only thought of that recently. In a way, her life is a form of Catherine Cookson rags to riches. Not that we were rich ever, but it's that sort of rise above, my mother used to say. And this is at the essence, I think, of Catherine Cookson's philosophy, probably from her own very difficult life.
And I'm sure that's why she was in her time and remains such a popular author, that whilst a lot of what she was writing about was miserable and brutal and, you know, hard working class life, there was a happy ending.
There was a rise above, yes, yes, which she did herself. And she was enormously loved locally at the end of her life and before the end of her life. She was a real heroine there.
I don't know how easy they are to narrate, but there's a wonderful musical quality to the writing that comes through when they are being narrated well.
I'm taking that as a compliment, thank you. Yes, it's because of the tune of the accent, and she does catch the dialogue very well. Some of her narration can be a little bit heavy, but yes, that you can hear that they are living, breathing Northumbrian people.
Yes, she clearly had an ear for dialogue, even though she was writing, I believe, she was living in Eastbourne for much of the time.
Quite a lot. Yes.
Clearly she missed the accent that had surrounded her when she was growing up.
Yes.
And do you remember much about making those recordings in the 60s and 70s and the studios that you were in?
The RNIB studios were on Great Portland Street when I started. And the sound insulation was not nearly as good as it is in this current building. The narrator would have his or her own cubicle shut up with a door, but the engineer would have his door open onto the corridor with people passing by all the time. And sometimes that did obviously bleed through. I mean, we get problems here with people talking in the corridor outside the studios. Because these microphones are extremely sensitive. The microphones we had then weren't so sensitive, but you still got bleed through. And also we had an embassy above us where they appeared every now and then to have some sort of party, clog dances. I really don't know what was going on, but it certainly rivaled drilling, which is one of the problems nowadays.
I shall listen very, very carefully to the Mallon Streak, which is what I'm listening to at the moment, see if I can hear any of it in the background.
I do hope that they managed to... Well, they wouldn't cut it out. We'd have to stop and wait until it finished and start again.
And we're in the lovely refurbished Talking Book Studios, which much of the refurbishment was only possible because of the Catherine Cookson Trust's generous donation for it to be done.
Absolutely.
So she carries on even 20 years after her death.
Yes, yes.
And another way in which she continues is in authors who were clearly very influenced by her and write in much the same vein. I noticed that you more recently have been narrating the Maggie Hope novels, which are fairly similar in the way they look back at a time of greater hardship.
That's right. And also very evocative of the countryside there. There's one, I can't remember which it is, but where there's a gill. Now, that is spelt G-H-Y-L-L. And I don't know that gills actually exist in any other county in these islands. But my grandmother's brother's farm, Amerston, there was a gill there. And my grandfather and I used to walk down what I called the chocolate staircase into the bottom of it. And it was a magical world. You know, that's very evocative in those books, and also the seaside, that very unforgiving north coast.
Bleak and beautiful at the same time.
Yes.
You've also narrated historical fact books about the northeast, haven't you?
William Armstrong, the biography of William Armstrong, fascinating man, and in fact did a great deal to put the modern Newcastle on the map. I mean, those bridges, the cantilever bridges, he invented those, all the hydraulic business and steam, and very, very interesting man, very ambitious as well.
I'm going back to read The Malin Streak. Is there a book that you're reading at the moment that you'd like to share with the listeners?
One of the recent ones I've read, miles away from Northumberland, was a gardening book by Marjorie Fish, who was one of the first, I think she was the first, of the lady gardeners, as they, I suppose they were, to put pen to paper about it. And it's quite an amusing book because she didn't really know what she was doing. She wasn't a natural gardener. Well, she was a natural gardener, but she wasn't taught in any way. And she had a husband who had rather different views from her. And Walter would say, no, that's not going to work. And she would get cross and do it anyway, plant whatever it was. And he was nearly always right. And she admits this. But there's an underlying, an undercurrent of a very odd marriage at the back of that. And that's called We Made a Garden. And another history book that I've recently read was Agincourt. And that is fascinating. If you're into lists and the details of what weaponry they amassed, the English amassed before they went, how many ships they took, how Henry went about actually constructing the army. He first went to his nobles, his they were sort of the Hagues of the army, and they delegated in each county. So it was a bit like the First World War in that counties of England were got together and produced, well, gave up fighting men. It's a fascinating book.
Well, that's a super recommendation, and clearly you are reading just as much now as you ever have been. I'm looking forward to the next 222 books going into the Talking Books library that have been narrated by you. But for the time being, Elizabeth Proud, thank you for being a guest on Read On.
Thank you. Thank you for asking me to come in.
He urged his horse up the rise, then stopped at the summit, as he always did, and sat gazing about him. The sky was high today, clear and blue, not resting as it usually did on the far low hills away to his left, or on the masts of the ships not so far away that lined the river. From this point he could see the town of South Shields, lying in a bustling huddle along the banks of the river, right to where it made its way into the North Sea.
My guest, Elizabeth Proud, narrating Tilly Trotter by Catherine Cookson. For a full list of Catherine Cookson titles narrated by Elizabeth Proud, go to rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999. That's 0303 123 9999. And to celebrate Catherine Cookson's remarkable life and legacy, RNIB Library has recently announced that the entire collection of titles written by her for adults will be made available in accessible formats, including Talking Books, within the year. Now, before we return to hear the books of Kathleen Jones's life, I must confess that, until we started planning this Catherine Cookson special, I'd never read any of her books. I'd been put off by some of the disparaging remarks that I'd heard about them being romantic potboilers set against the harsh background of working-class Tyneside in the early 20th century. So I picked up The 15 Streets, one of the first of her nearly 100 books, with a degree of trepidation. The title refers to a slum area of South Shields, populated mainly by Irish dockworkers and their families. While the men try to eke out a living by unloading cargo ships, their women try to make ends meet and keep their many children alive. It's an existence tormented by poverty, drink, violence, and crushing convention, and one that Cookson knew well, having herself grown up in South Shields in the early 1900s.
poverty is comparative. There were those who didn't live in the 15 streets who considered the people living there to be of one stratum, the lowest stratum. But the people inside this stratum knew that there were three different levels, the upper, the middle, and the lower. All lived in houses, either upstairs or down, but in the lower end, each house had only two small rooms, and upstairs or down, the conditions were the same. The plaster on the walls was alive with bugs. These might only appear at night to drop on the huddled sleepers, but that strange odour, which was peculiarly their own, wafted through the houses all the time, stamping them as buggy. No one went to live in the lower end unless he was forced. To the middle and upper 15 streets, the bottom end was only one step removed from the workhouse, for its inhabitants were usually those whose furniture had been distrained or who had been ejected from their former houses for non-payment of rent. There were three nightmares in the lives of the occupants of the middle and upper 15 streets, and these were linked together. They were the bums, the lower end, and the workhouse.
John O'Brien is the book's hero, the eldest of five children living in a squalid, overcrowded flat on one of the 15 streets. Between labouring to earn enough to keep the family from starvation and protecting his mother and sisters from his drunken father and brutal brother, John has little time to think about making a better life for himself. But he does want one for his younger sister, Katie, who works hard at school and dreams of becoming a teacher. He begins to see how this may be possible when a non-Catholic family moves next door. The Brackens preach tolerance and spiritual enlightenment through reading and discussion, unlike the fire and brimstone promised by the local Catholic priest. But John is in a minority. The Brackens' nonconformity is greeted with fear and persecution, even from other members of the O'Brien family. A similar scandalised reaction awaits John when he and Katie's teacher, Mary Llewellyn, fall in love. As a middle-class girl from a better part of town, Mary is seen as an outsider, certainly too good for a docker like John. Their love gives rise to jealousy and resentment and unleashes further misery onto the 15 streets. It's a compelling story that kept me turning the pages and willing John, Katie and Miss Llewellyn onto a happier existence. Catherine Cookson immerses the reader in the world of the 15 streets. Her descriptions of its damp houses, sparse furnishings and meagre provisions are vivid but never lurid. Her mastery of the local dialect lifts her characters off the page and lends itself particularly well to being read as a talking book.
They walked on in silence, and he told himself it was only a kid's trick. Yes, it might be, any kid's, but not Katie's. It was this blasted, soul-shrivelling poverty, where a bairn was driven to steal because she hadn't a halfpenny. The thought persisted that because she'd done it once, she would do it again, and that by the time she left school and was ready for a place, she'd be a dab hand at lifting.
At heart, this is a slice of social history, written with the same moral outrage as other authors such as Dickens, Hardy, and later Frank McCourt. Its characters are likewise menaced by abject poverty, class conventions and religious bigotry. Violence is never far away, and Cookson certainly isn't afraid of showing its tragic consequences to shock her readers into sharing her own indignation. So any happy ending that her characters might have is hard-earned and far from schmaltzy. In the end, I thought this was a really well-written, heartfelt and thought-provoking book. It raised questions about religion and self-belief that are as pertinent today as those about poverty and aspiration. It also shone a light on just how bad life was for the poor and the disabled 100 years ago, before the foundation of the welfare state. The 15 Streets by Catherine Cookson is brilliantly narrated by Marlene Sidaway as TB7782. It's also available in Braille and Giant Print. Do you have an educating read suggestion that you think would expand my reading horizons? Or maybe you found a hidden gem in the library that you'd like to share? Why not drop us a line via the usual email address, readonair@rnib.org.uk. We'd love to hear from you. Now it's back to Catherine Cookson's biographer, Kathleen Jones, to share the books of her life. Kathleen, was there a book that you read as a child or a young woman that made you fall in love with writing?
It wasn't so much falling in love with writing, because I was writing from being a very small child. I loved writing, telling stories. It was more recognising myself as a writer and that you could be a writer. When I was about 11 or 12, I read Little Women, which is the story of four sisters in 19th century America. And the sisters are all very different, and they're all very different types of women, and they fall into different categories. There is Meg, the eldest, who is going to make the good marriage and be a good wife and look after her husband and sacrifice herself for her husband and her children. And there's Amy, who is obviously going to be the glamorous girl who goes out and gets the rich man and leads this wonderful lifestyle. She's the glamour girl. Then there's Beth, who is the one who is ill and who lies on the sofa looking pale and interesting. But this was another stereotype of females in the 19th century, the young woman who wasted away and was too good for this world. Beth is an angel. And then there's Jo, who is rebellious. She's a tomboy, as I was. She wants to be a writer. She writes stories. She gets into trouble for writing sometimes, which I did. And in Jo, I recognised myself, and it gave me a clear identity, and I loved that. And I still love Little Women today.
Christmas won't be Christmas without any presents, grumbled Jo, lying on the rug. It's so dreadful to be poor, sighed Meg, looking down at her old dress. I don't think it's fair for some girls to have plenty of pretty things and other girls nothing at all, added little Amy with an injured sniff. We've got father and mother and each other, said Beth contentedly from her corner. The four young faces on which the firelight shone brightened at the cheerful words, but darkened again as Jo said sadly, We haven't got father, and shall not have him for a long time. She didn't say, perhaps never, but each silently added it, thinking of father far away where the fighting was. Nobody spoke for a minute, then Meg said in an altered tone, You know, the reason mother proposed not having any presents this Christmas was because it is going to be a hard winter for everyone, and she thinks we ought not to spend money for pleasure when our men are suffering so in the army. We can't do much, but we can make our little sacrifices, and ought to do it gladly. But I am afraid I don't. And Meg shook her head, as she thought regretfully of all the pretty things she wanted.
Liza Ross narrating Little Women by Louisa May Alcott, which is TB21665. And it's also available in Braille and giant print. And is there a book that on a rainy day you'd like to curl up with and reread?
I particularly like Pride and Prejudice because it is the perfect comfort reading. Everybody gets their comeuppance in the end. So it's very satisfying. The good girl, Jane, who is the older sister, gets the very unexceptional, rather boring Mr. Bingley, but she's happy and she has a good social position. Elizabeth Bennet, who's a little bit of a rebel, outspoken, standing up for herself, she, of course, gets the glorious Mr. Darcy. And her young sister, Lydia, who runs off with a soldier at the age of 15, she gets her comeuppance because she has to marry him and she's saddled with him for life. And Mr. Wickham, who is the dangerous soldier, the rake, he gets his comeuppance because he's forced to marry Lydia, which is going to really cramp his style for the rest of his life. And Lady Catherine de Bourgh, who is the snob, the arch snob, she gets her an absolute put down. So, you know, I just love it because it's a happy ending. It's amusing. it's warm, funny, and everybody gets the right ending.
It is a truth universally acknowledged that a single man in possession of a good fortune must be in want of a wife. However little known the feelings or views of such a man may be on his first entering a neighbourhood, this truth is so well fixed in the minds of the surrounding families that he is considered as the rightful property of some one or other of their daughters. "My dear Mr. Bennet," said his lady to him one day, "have you heard that Netherfield Park is let at last?" Mr. Bennet replied that he had not. "But it is," returned she, "for Mrs. Long has just been here, and she told me all about it." Mr. Bennet made no answer. "Do not you want to know who has taken it?" cried his wife impatiently. "You want to tell me, and I have no objection to hearing it."
Jane Austen's classic Pride and Prejudice is TB13967, and it's narrated by Emilia Fox. And did Catherine Cookson have a favourite book?
Yes, she did, and it's quite an unusual choice. She loved Lord Chesterfield's Letters to His Son, which is a very old book written by Lord Chesterfield to his illegitimate son, on how to become a gentleman. And Catherine took this to heart because as a child she fantasized about her own father being an aristocrat. And these letters written by Lord Chesterfield to his illegitimate son spoke to her because she could imagine her own aristocratic father writing these letters to her. And she also wanted very much to become a lady. And she thought that what he was teaching his son would be relevant to herself. And so she kept these as a kind of, it was her guide to etiquette and how to deal with people, how to, it was about deportment, about social interaction, and all sorts of other things. And she read and reread and reread these. The book that she owned is in Newcastle University archives, and it is falling apart, the pages are falling apart, and held together by tape, because she read it so often, and she kept it until she died, and she was still rereading it.
Lord Chesterfield's Letters to His Son are sadly not available from the RNIB library, but the full text and several recordings are freely available online, including this LibriVox recording.
Dear boy, your distresses in your journey from Heidelberg to Schaffhausen, your lying upon straw, your black bread, and your broken berline, are proper seasonings for the greater fatigues and distresses, which you must expect in the course of your travels. And if one had a mind to moralize, one might call them the samples of the accidents, rubs, and difficulties, which every man meets with in his journey through life.
And finally, is there a book that you've read recently that you'd like to share with the Read On listeners?
Yes, my most cherished novel that I've read recently is by Maggie O'Farrell, and it's The Hand That First Held Mine, which I loved, I wept over, and I've actually read it twice. And it's two interlocking stories, which at the beginning of the novel, you don't realise how they're going to come together. It's very cleverly woven. First of all, it's the story of Lexi, who, after the war, runs off to London with a bit of a rake in a sports car. She wants a more interesting life than her parents are able to provide, and she gets it. And then it's the story also of Elena and Ted. Now, Elena has recently had a baby and is suffering severe postnatal depression, and her husband doesn't really understand why. And he's having strange dreams and flashbacks to something he doesn't really understand. The story is really about memory and how selective our memories are and how we tend to blank out things that are unpleasant or that we don't really want to remember. And in the end, of course, Ted's memory finally comes back and Elena is coming out of her postnatal depression. And we find out how their stories interlink with Lexi's story. and it's just beautiful, poignant, moving book with a lovely ending.
Listen. The trees in this story are stirring, trembling, readjusting themselves. A breeze is coming in gusts off the sea, and it is almost as if the trees know in their restlessness, in their head-tossing impatience, that something is about to happen. The garden is empty, the patio deserted, save for some pots with geraniums and delphiniums shuddering in the wind. A bench stands on the lawn, two chairs facing politely away from it. A bicycle is propped up against the house, but its pedals are stationary, the oiled chain motionless. A baby has been put out to sleep in a pram, and it lies inside its stiff cocoon of blankets, eyes obligingly shut tight. A seagull hangs suspended in the sky above, and even that is silent, beak closed, wings outstretched to catch the high thermal drafts. The house is set apart from the rest of the village, behind dense hedge on the crest of a cliff. This is the border between Devon and Cornwall, where the two counties crouch, eyeing each other. It is a much disputed piece of land.
The Hand That First Held Mine by Maggie O'Farrell and narrated by Dawn Murphy is TB17704. Kathleen Jones, thank you so much for not only sharing your life of Catherine Cookson, but your obvious love of books with the Read On listeners.
Thank you.
Thanks again to Kathleen Jones. Don't forget, you can share the books of your life by emailing us at the usual address, readonair@rnib.org.uk. We'd love to hear your choices. Alas, that's all we've got time for this week. My thanks to all my guests, to the Catherine Cookson Charitable Trust, and to everyone who's been in touch. Read On will be back at the same time next week, but if you can't wait that long, why not head to our Audio Boom page? All our past shows are there, complete with book news, reviews, and exclusive author interviews. You'll find a link on the front page of our website, rnibconnectradio.org.uk, or you can find producer Robert on Twitter @talking_books. Farewell until next week, and remember to read on.